Welcome to another episode of our EWTN series, exploring the life, work, and thought of the Venerable Cardinal John Henry Newman. Today's guest is Father Rutler, who will be speaking to us on the Oxford Movement. Father Rutler is, of course, very familiar to all of you viewers of EWTN, having been on many different shows through the years. His background is that he was a former Anglican priest himself. He has degrees from Dartmouth, Johns Hopkins College, Oxford, and also the Anglican University in Rome. Thank you for coming down here to Birmingham from New York, a very familiar place for you, to speak to us about the Oxford Movement. Well, perhaps for our viewers who've been hearing a lot about the Oxford Movement in terms of some of the other episodes that we've had during these weeks, perhaps you could just tell us briefly what is the Oxford Movement, what are its antecedents, and what did it mean for the Anglican Church of that time?
The movement itself was called the Oxford Movement only in retrospect. The people who launched it didn't see it as anything more than a revitalization, a recovery of identity on the part of the members of the established church. The Church of England was precisely that, as it understood itself. It was established by law. It was a government institution. Over the centuries, it had lost focus. Well, by its very origin, you might say it lacked focus, because when Henry VIII broke with the Catholic Church, the established church was a substitute, perpetuating as much as it could without the fullness of the church's credentials, a sacramental life, proclamation of the gospel. But because it lacked authentic roots, it gradually lost a sense of its supernatural character, or what was supposed to be its supernatural character. Newman was a central voice in the movement, which began in his university of Oxford. And he said at one point that Rome could claim Catholicity, Anglicanism could claim antiquity, by which he really meant that the Church of England sought to convince its members and others by virtue of the fact that it had been there quite a long time. The Church of England claimed to have been the church that had been in England, planted in England even before St. Augustine had arrived. So it was over 1,300 years of a presence, but that's all. It was just that historical a presence that it could claim. It did not have the doctrinal credentials that Rome had. Now, when Newman and some of the brighter young clergymen in the University of Oxford spoke about the Catholic identity of the Church of England, they did not think in terms of becoming Roman Catholic. They subscribed to what they called a branch theory, that there was a Roman Catholic Church, Church of Rome, there was the Byzantine Church, and then there was the Church of England. And as far as they were concerned, the Church of England really could be the model for how the whole church universal should be. It was, as they said, one way or another, the via media, the middle road between extremes, primarily between what they considered the superstitious claims of popery and the aridity and heresy of Protestantism. So the Oxford Movement basically was a call to the Church of England itself to remember, as they believed, that it was part of the traditional Catholic church.
When did the Oxford Movement, or at least as regarded as national, really begin? In what year, and who spurred it on?
Well, as with all movements, again, you try to hang your hat on a hook ex post facto. Looking back, Newman said very precisely, it was July 14, 1833. July 14, also Bastille Day, just a coincidence. He said that because his great friend, an older professor of poetry in the university, John Keble, preached on that day to the judges who were assembled at the opening of the
assizes,
the courts of the assize. It was called the assize sermon. He preached in the university church to them on a rather complicated issue in Ireland. The government, the parliament had decided to cut back on dioceses. There were too many dioceses in Ireland. Now, when I say diocese, I mean the Protestant diocese, or the Church of Ireland, which was the Anglican Church in England. There were not very many in Ireland anyway, and it was an economy measure. And it really made a lot of practical sense. But from the theological point of view, for someone who believed that a bishop was a successor of the apostles and that the church was apostolic, this was a tremendous affront. Parliament, the government, had no business at doing this. Now, historically, because the church was a government institution, because it was established, the government did regulate things. But when it came to deciding what the bishop should do, this was a total contradiction of as they saw the supernatural character of the church to be. So Newman said that 1833, July 14th, was the clarion call. And from that time on...
The title of the sermon was? National Apostasy.
Well, that's what it came to be called.
Mm-hmm.
And people did believe it was a form of apostasy. The nation had lost its moorings in the apostolic succession. But, of course, you know, he's speaking as an intellectual who believed that. For most of the people, it made no sense whatsoever. A bishop was a government official, a functionary, an amiable man. The leading bishops sat in the House of Lords, and they were ministers of morals. It's really not very different from, I think, the common perception of bishops in the church today.
Perhaps we could just stop you for a moment and ask you, maybe we could step back a little bit further. What were the various types of Anglicans at that time in a theological sense? Was there already a nonconformist or high church or low church or the two-bottle orthodox? So we can understand what the Oxford movement meant and when it came into being.
The 18th century was a very dry time. It was a period of what we would call Erastianism. Basically, the idea that the church was a civil institution with spiritual decoration meant to keep the people in moral obedience. Before the 18th century, there was a deep consciousness of a supernatural life of grace. There was what was called high church, or sometimes Laudian, theology, named for Archbishop Laud, who was Archbishop of Canterbury under King Charles I, and they both were beheaded. You have to remember that. They both were beheaded by, in retrospect, Congregationalists, the Cromwellians, because they believed in a supernatural church with bishops. Now, it wasn't Roman Catholic. That was called old-fashioned high churchmanship, and that continued to a certain extent. In fact, one of the great old-fashioned high churchmen, interestingly enough, became father to the two famous Wesleys.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 18th century, you had something a bit like, not exactly, like the charismatic movement, an attempt to reinvigorate a spiritual life in a very dry patch. Charles Wesley always remained in the Church of England. John Wesley, his brother, one of the founders, with George Whitfield of Methodism, didn't think of himself as anything but Church of England, but he did go out and then he commissioned ministers without episcopal permission. That was a primary focus in the Church of England, but then the Methodist movement became schismatic.
Who were the leaders of the Oxford movement along with or beside the Venerable John Henry?
Well, the movement originally was called, more often than not, the Puseyite movement. Edward Blueberry Pusey was a professor, Regius professor of Hebrew in the university. His studies of the scriptures and his moral influence on many of the young minds really helped focus things. John Keble, I mentioned, was almost a mystical figure in the university at the time. He was so much admired for his piety. Later on, Newman said that Keble would have been another St. Philip Neri, if he had only had some of those advantages. There's no question that the great poet Keble had an enormous influence. There was another fellow, Harold Froude, who died young. He was much aware of the medieval sensibilities of the English tradition. He was very much of a romantic. All this, you see, fits in with the romantic revival at the time, a new interest in the Middle Ages, architecturally, and so on. Newman was a young don. He was not so much a professor as we would think, because he was a tutor and, above all else, vicar of the university church. And it was from the pulpit that he taught. And his influence became so vital that the professors were very nervous at this line he was preaching, and they rescheduled tea time or dinner time so that the students wouldn't go to hear him, but they gave up dinner to hear him. So that, I think, witnesses to how powerful Newman's voice was. There were many other clerics involved in this at the same time.
Besides the preaching, which we're going to examine and have you back again as a guest to talk particularly about Newman and his preaching, what were the other ways that the Tractarian, is also called the Tractarian movement, I believe, how did it get its message out, I guess not to the masses as such, but to the more influential clergy or aristocracy?
Well, they used the media of the day, the Post or the Pony Express, literally so, I suppose. Newman and his friends, but Newman especially, went around on horseback delivering these tracts, pamphlets, leaflets. That's why it's also called the Tractarian movement, mostly to the vicarages, the rectories, with the clergy houses. They knew that the clergy would read these and then they would pass them on. So he had a writing team. He wrote many of the tracts himself. There were 90 in all. The tract writing began in 1833, the year of the Assize Sermon, and then culminated with Tract 90, which was condemned in 1841.
Who actually wrote the infamous Tract 90?
That was Newman.
It was Newman himself.
Yeah, Newman. And his point there was that they were trying to work with what they had. In a sense, they were ultra-conservative. They were trying to revive what had been. But because it was so forgotten, it was radical. And they were reminding the bishops that they were successors of the apostles. And this upset a lot of the bishops. That in the Church of England, they were married, and their wives didn't, I think, like the idea very much. You know, the idea of going out and getting eaten by lions and things like that, or even being related to people who had. The sacramental character of the Church, the fact that the Eucharist was the true body and blood of Christ. And that's really, in the end, what got Newman into his final bath of hot water. He took the 39 articles. These were basic Protestant statements at the end of the prayer book, or attached to the prayer book, Reformation statements, and showed how they could be reinterpreted in a Catholic way, so that one could subscribe as a loyal Anglican and still hold to a Catholic theology. Quick example. There's one article which says that the Eucharist is not to be held up, is not meant to be held up and worshipped. This was a denial of benediction of the Blessed Sacrament, but really it was a cut at theology of real presence. And Newman said, well, while it wasn't ordained, it doesn't mean that it couldn't be done. So this was real hair-splitting. And he realized by this point that it was futile.
When the moment came for the split, did anyone other than John Henry Newman leave the Oxford movement, or any one of the other supposed leaders, or did they remain in the Anglican Church?
The principal ones, Pusey, remained. He became a founder, a nurturer of religious orders, a very esteemed and revered spiritual director. He saw from that point on his primary job was to keep the young Anglicans in the university together so that they could continue this revival of the church without poping, or whatever the term of the day might have been. Keble didn't leave the Church of England. He became a vicar in a little country parish, Hursley, and people would visit him to his dying day as though they were going to see a great father of the church. They really went on pilgrimage. Froude died, but a great many of the younger lights eventually did follow Newman. Newman himself eventually resigned his position as vicar of the university church. He preached a famous parting sermon called The Parting of Friends, not in the university church, but in the church which he had built just outside Oxford, in Littlemore. Interestingly enough, Pusey said the Eucharist.
In that particular service?
Yeah, and Newman wanted to have his final sermon at a service of Holy Communion, right? And not morning prayer. And he finished his sermon, and he took his hood, or his academic hood, off, and he put it on the communion rail and left. It's one of the great moments, I think, in modern Christian history, certainly one of the most moving, and the sermon was one of Newman's most emotive. In that same little village, which was a pretty tumble-down place, very shabby, there was real poverty, and Newman, with all his interest in intellectual pursuits, was very much a man of the people, a man attentive to the needs of the neglected. He set up in what basically were stables in Littlemore, a little retreat house, and a couple of friends joined him, and they lived there a monastic life, what we would consider a monastic life, until 1845, October 9, when Newman was received into the church. Many years later, Newman now Catholic, Keble's wife was dying, and Newman went to pay respects. Pusey was there already in Keble's parish in Hursley, and when Newman arrived, Keble looked at him and didn't recognize him. They had both changed so much over the years, and then Pusey came back from the church where he had been reading his evening office, and they had a little get together, but it was kind of awkward. But there again, I think that's one of the most poignant images of the Victorian age, these three truly virtuous people who chose different courses are really physically bearing signs of all that they had endured.
And did the Oxford movement continue after Newman's defection, or its impact continues even up this day to one extent or another in the Anglican Church or its representatives in other countries?
Inasmuch as the Church of England was the established church, the real offense wasn't so much heresy, because there wasn't too much orthodoxy to be heretical about. It was more treason. So when one left the Church of England, one was really becoming a traitor to one's friends and one's culture, one's nation even. After all, it was in about 1829 that Catholicism was tolerated as a legal entity. But the movement continued and very much flourished. When Keble died, friends subscribed to a massive college in his honor within the university, Keble College, this Pusey house. Mm-hmm. And the Tractarian movement, the Puseyite movement, the Oxford movement, because it was not very welcome in many of the more select social circles of the day, moved into the slums of London, Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, did a great deal of social work, and sent missionaries, including prominent missionary bishops, all through the empire. I think the Oxford movement peaked in the beginning of the 20th century when the centenary celebrations for the Assize Sermon were celebrated. There was an international witness to the what had borne fruit over the years, but everything, I think, pretty much was downhill after that.
Who were some of the more prominent converts that came out of the Oxford movement following the example of Cardinal Newman?
Well, the Wilberforces. The Wilberforces were a notable family. Mr. Wilberforce was the Abraham Lincoln of his day. He was the abolitionist, and he secured the abolition of slavery. He and one or two others are contenders for that title some 30 years before we did, the Emancipation Proclamation. And his family, many of his family, joined the movement. There was the Ward family. There, of course, most conspicuously, I suppose, Henry Manning, who was a student when Newman was vicar, used to go and hear Newman, and eventually became Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster.
Some of our viewers may be familiar with the old publishing house Sheed and Ward, and the Ward of that publishing house is a descendant from W.G. Ward.
Mazie Ward's father, mm-hmm. Grandfather, who didn't really get on all that well with Newman. We talk about the via media, and Newman began to see that there could really be no via media, but truth is no half-truth. But he was a man of supernatural balance. And as a Catholic, he saw the damage that extremists were doing. You had the slothful Catholics on one side, and then eventually modernism, which rejected essentials of the faith. Then you have what were called the ultramontanists, who thought themselves more Catholic than the Pope. They did not understand the development of doctrine, which is a key for Newman's thought. And Ward was one of those. He used to say he would like to have had a paper bull for breakfast every morning. And everyone was suspicious of Newman precisely because he was balanced. You know, it reminds me of something that G.K. Chesterton once said, that if a midget describes to you a man saying he's off too tall, and a very tall man says he's too short, and so on and so forth, and maybe he's just the right height. And I think that was the case with Newman. The Oxford movement also launched a profound literary and scholarly revival, which has affected many people.
Who are some of the names that came out of that?
Well, John Mason Neal is my favorite, actually. Mm-hmm. He translated many old Catholic hymns. He always stayed in the Church of England. But
so our viewers can open up, including Catholic hymnals today, and find some of his...
Most of those, the great hymns.
Mm-hmm. What would be an example of one of those?
Well, all the St. Bernard cycle. Mm-hmm. Oh, what their joy and their glory must be, Jerusalem, mm-hmm. the golden, and so on. Most of what we consider the great classic hymns today, more popular hymns, holy, 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 and that, were written by Tractarian clergymen. We have to remember that they were really the leading intellectual scholarly lights of the day. Another convert was Frederick William Faber, who then teamed up with Newman, and their relationship certainly was historic and tense, to say the least. They were very different personalities, but Faber wrote many hymns we know of today, Faith mm-hmm. of Our Fathers, and he had some very good ones. He was like the Goldilocks with the curl and, you know, in her forehead. When she was good, she was very, very good. When she was bad, she was horrid. Some of the greatest hymns of the 19th century written by Faber, and also some of the worst.
Well, wonderful. You've given us a real introduction to the Oxford movement, and Father George Rutler is a prominent convert himself from the Anglican persuasion, we could say, is hopefully a harbinger of good things to come that have already come to pass in this century. And again, thank you, Father George, for being with us today.
Great pleasure.